Mullinger Meets Canadians is brought to you by Nova Scotia Business Incorporated. Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. This week's very special guest is Wolf Castle, a 24-year-old Indigenous Mi'kmaq rapper, producer and singer from Pabano First Nation. Growing up on the reservation with an incredibly supportive family of artists, movie directors and musicians, a career in the arts seemed like the natural choice for this talented young gentleman, whose real name is Tristan Grant. Everything about Tristan defies the odds. He taught himself how to play piano at the age of 11, he writes and records all of his own work, and has been releasing music projects every year since the age of 17. He found huge success playing festivals across Canada and quickly secured nominations at the East Coast Music Awards for Indigenous Artist of the Year and for Recording of the Year. His music carries a powerful energy and wisdom beyond his years, covering topics such as love, empowerment, having a good time, and thinking big. Mixing pop rap with old school beats, his lyrics have been described as catchy and confessional. Wolf Castle likes to keep listeners on their toes and delivers a new perspective on being a young Indigenous man. This year he's nominated for two more East Coast Music Awards, Rap Hip Hop Recording of the Year for Gold Rush and the 2021 Indigenous Artist of the Year Award. Wolf Castle is also part of the ECMA Festival and Conference this coming May, from the 5th to the 9th in Sydney, Nova Scotia. For more information on the 2021 ECMAs, please visit ecma.com. The week before we spoke, he released Gunna, the first single from his upcoming EP via the Halifax, Nova Scotia-based label Forward Music Group, one of Canada's most respected record labels, proudly based in Nova Scotia. It's an instant classic, and we can't stop playing it in the edit office. Flames burst on a jet ski, flying through the air up on top of the tsunami. I'm Johnny Machiavelli, wave a finger in the air. You can hear a pin drop. In a few short years, Wolf Castle has grown from a bedroom producer into one of the most prolific and important Indigenous hip-hop artists working in Canada today. I'm a huge fan and I can't wait to chat. So here we go. Tristan, how are you, mate?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. I must start by saying congratulations on your well-deserved East Coast Music Award nominations. How does that feel?
It feels super good because I've been working quite a lot just in quarantine and not really doing shows too much. So I haven't seen a lot of like physical, real life affirmations that what I'm doing is correct and right. So it's good that I'm finally, I have something that I am like, okay, great. I'm on the right track.
That's amazing. I mean, but you are someone that did not let lockdown get to you, or it certainly seems that way. Like, I mean, very quickly you recorded Cha Cha, which was one of my favorite songs of last year. Just absolutely amazing track. I mean, you were able to do that in quarantine, in lockdown. How did you manage to transition your kind of creativity of being on the road and performing live into suddenly being trapped but still being able to be creative?
I've had a very weird career. I don't think it's gone the way that most people go about it, because it's been very DIY, very flying by the seat of my pants, like not doing the things that bands or artists do. Like, I still haven't gone on my own like official Wolf Castle tour. I haven't done that yet, and like I've hopped on other tours and stuff, but like the beginning of my career up to now, I always say it's been about 5 years since I've been doing this professionally. I've been doing like in the beginning, I did a lot of cultural events and Indigenous events and stuff like that. And the whole time up until last fall, like 2019 fall, I guess, I'd been in school. Like, I have a bachelor's degree in drama. Right. And I have a one-year certificate at Nova Scotia Community College for music business. So I was always in school kind of balancing everything and doing everything from my bedroom and at home. And there's a lot of reasons for for that, just kind of lack of accessibility to studios. And a lot of my friends were not really musicians. so I didn't, you know what I mean? So like the equipment and everything, and it wasn't really accessible to me. So I just slowly started working kind of in-house and figuring out how to record myself and write music. And, you know, I didn't know how to play piano, but I wanted to take beats off of YouTube, and my mom was like, no, make your own. So I just made my own and I figured it all out. So that's kind of what I've been doing.
It's amazing. I mean, you taught yourself piano at 11. I mean, you are someone who has clearly been determined to forge their own path and also not let restrictions get in your way. Like, where do you think that drive came from?
Yeah, I think that comes from, I'm in a family of artists that are very active and very colorful characters. And I grew up surrounded by that. And I had a lot of really good examples from a young age of people that have just kind of done their own thing and been successful for doing it. I like to joke in interviews or on stage and when I meet people that if I chose to be a scientist or a mathematician or something, my family would have been like, what are you talking about? Be an artist. Like, it was amazing. Like the opposite. Yeah. 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 Because my mom is an artist and she was like already successful when I was very young. And my uncle was doing rap when I was 6 years old. And actually my mom was on stage with him and she put her own rap album out. So that's always kind of an interesting angle that people are really attached to, is just kind of growing up in a family of musicians and artists. Like, that was kind of my mom's side thing too, because she was she went to animation college when I was 5 or 6, and she actually left because she pitched a film to the National Film Board of Canada and they actually took it and greenlit it, and she made a film. So I've just kind of been surrounded by this creativity, and seeing that all kind of in my own community, it was so, and within my family, was so inspiring. And I think that's what gave me the sort of almost like a support blanket to be like, you know, I can go for this and there's no real pressure to like do anything great or amazing. It's just kind of follow your heart. So I've always kind of kept that with me this whole time. So that's kind of, I think, where it all comes from.
That's incredible. And as you rightly say, I mean, it is the greatest gift that parents and indeed any family can give a child, is encouraging them in a creative field, in artistic ventures. And it's strange that traditionally it isn't something which families, or indeed, you know, organizations, schools, governments actually do embrace. And why do you think that is, given how much the arts contributes to this and indeed any country's economic output? This is, you know, the arts are the things that touch every single business, every single, you know, from restaurants, hotels, tourism. But yet the arts traditionally isn't supported or embraced. Why do you think that is?
It's such a good question, because it's so easy. Like, you can't really lose that argument of like, listen, why are you not funding the arts? Because it literally, like if, you know, like the arts are so important, but if you're talking to non-artists who just care about the numbers, it is so easy to be like, look at these numbers. Like, yes, culture contributes so much to the economy. It's unbelievable. So like, yeah, it's so important to support that. I really don't know like what mindset that is, but it's so prevalent, especially kind of in areas, I don't know why, so like, and I'm no expert in this, but like, it seems so prevalent in small towns and places that are kind of like, you know, towns whose economy kind of relies on mining, or like in Bathurst, where I'm from and live currently, like there used to be a paper mill and a mine and everything like that. And I guess it was very like industrial kind of run. And I think the results from that sort of economic boost just maybe told the larger public that this is what makes towns rich and thrive and builds the population. But if you don't build the art scene, then when that stuff goes away, we're kind of screwed as artists. Because, you know, that there was a paper mill in Bathurst and it closed. There was a mine, it closed. And now, like, you know, when I was a teenager up until now, a lot of people were going out west to Alberta to work at the oil fields or whatever, you know, and being gone for months at a time. Very strange. And it's weird that attitude exists, but you know, it's a shame because I think because of that, we've probably lost a lot of talented people who could have gone down this path and done really amazing things. So it's a real shame because you have to go through just a really stupid amount of pushback to even try and be an artist. I'm sure you can relate as a comedian.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one of those things that has been prevalent for so long. I mean, I feel like in some ways the tide is turning. And of course, we're obviously lucky to have organizations like, you know, East Coast Music Association who are supporting artists. But you're right. It's such a strange thing that this mentality has even existed, given, you know, on the one hand, you know, art is obviously an amazing and beautiful thing and has been known to be historically. Obviously an amazing thing for people to enjoy, people's mental health. But as you say, as soon as you go down the economics route and the numbers route, which is what, you know, pleases capitalists, you can, the evidence is there, right? You know, I mean, you talk about a town like, you know, a situation like Bathurst, you know, if a big show is in town, every single taxi company, hotel, restaurant, bar, store, every business benefits from that. But as you say, it's too rarely seen. But I mean, you've obviously, you know, it's such a wonderful thing to hear about someone growing up with a supportive family of artists. And I love hearing that. And am I right in thinking, did your uncle perform on your most recent song, Gunnar?
Yes, he did. He did.
Amazing. Amazing. What was that like?
It was amazing because he was a rapper in like 2003, going under the name Red Sugar. And I asked him, I actually had never asked him before, but yesterday I texted him and I said, "Hey, why did you like decide to be a rapper when you were 20 years old all those years ago?" And without missing a beat, he just texted me back and said, "The lifestyle, limos, cars, all that stuff." Like, I feel like that was a funny answer, but I think where he was coming from was, you know, we're from this kind of small town that relies on kind of trades and industry, and we're from a reserve, which is in itself like has its own kind of lifestyle. And I think he was a big dreamer, you know, and just an artist fully. And he was strong enough to make that jump himself, right? Like my grandparents were very supportive and wonderful people, but you know, like they weren't really full-time artists. Like my grandfather for sure, like he was a storyteller and an educator, but that generation of my family, my aunts and uncles and my mom, like started this whole kind of arts thing, but it was based off of, I guess, the groundwork that my grandparents kind of laid down to be kind of open and accepting of stuff. But it was amazing for him to make that leap. And ultimately that led to me being like, yeah, I want to be a rapper too. And when we were like, I would say 9 years ago, you know, he had gone through school as well and got his master's degree and all that. And I was about 16, 15 years old, and I had started getting really into rap, and I started being like, this is what I want. And he would come home for the holidays, and we would all hang out at my grandparents' house because he had lived in Halifax at the time. And when we got there, I just told him like, hey, I'm really getting into rap right now. And he was also getting back into it just kind of in his own way. And he had like the cheap mics and the, you know, Cubase and all these like DAWs and stuff. And my cousin, who's 5 years younger than me, he was like 9 at the time. He was just like, hey, I'm making a song tonight just because I'm bored. Like, you want to do it? And I was like, oh my God, yes, of course. And I was terrified. But I just like wanted to do it so bad because I was inspired by a lot of artists that were coming up. And so we had spent the next, I don't know, 4 years, like 4 or 5 years, every holiday season, meeting up at my grandparents' house and making rap songs from scratch, literally till like 7 in the morning. Wow. And that was kind of where I got my rap training, how to be so thrifty and DIY and stuff, because he, you know, he would buy mics from Value Village or something, or just kind of get, you know, these programs, and we would just go for it. And what I really appreciate about him was he wasn't all precious about the art either, like, because obviously me and my cousin were like not skilled and like we're just learning, but he provided kind of, you know, this space where we could just rap about whatever, and even if the song was whack and bad, like, he didn't seem to care. Like, I think he just loved having fun, and I think that taught me how to have fun with it. So we did that for a long time, and then he was really my mentor for the next couple of years after that. When I started kind of performing, he would come on stage with me and be my hype man or be my DJ, and he really taught me how to perform. Like, he was really the guy I was watching and learning from. And so then after a while, he got a job at a university, and he just kind of stopped kind of doing rap super full time and or just going on the road and stuff, because he had also just started a family. And I was really hurt by that, or just crushed, because it sucked because I didn't have this mentor with me. But that was time for me to kind of go on my own and learn kind of apply what I had learned over the years from him. So that was kind of silent for a while, but we still hung out all the time. And when pandemic hit, I think he was at home a lot, and he's a really creative guy. I think he just had this spark of, I want to make, you know, this kind of music again. And he sent me a demo for Gunna. And I said, oh man, it's been like 3 years since we made a song together. Like, I'm friggin' doing this right now. So I just wrote a verse the same way we would do it. He was in Halifax. I was in Bathurst. We did it over the internet. And I sat down, wrote a verse, recorded it in my room, sent it off. And then we got it done. And that's the song that is out now.
Amazing. I mean, it is absolutely, it's instant classic. I mean, I can't stop playing it. I mean, and I know the feedback from it has been incredible. How does that feel now, like, that, you know, that you're having this great year after a year like last year when everything was kind of, you know, essentially our lives were paused, and suddenly now East Coast Music Award nominations, new EP, people going crazy for it. Like, you know, how do you feel now?
First of all, I'm really grateful and happy, because like, I used to, when I was, I don't know, 14 and I 15 and I really had a dream of being a rapper or some sort of entertainer or something. I couldn't sleep at night. I wanted it so bad. So to suddenly, you know, it wasn't sudden, it was years of work, but to be in a position where all of a sudden there's buzz and there's people talking about me and there's always, you know, interviews like this going on. I'm just like, what the heck? What the heck happened? This is fantastic. You know, it's gotten a lot busier in the last 6 months, and I don't know why. I think maybe I've just done enough work that and kept enough connections that, I don't know. I think I'm just when the opportunities show up, I've done the work where I'm ready to take them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, what you said about the fact that from day one, when you were creating music in your bedroom, you were doing it for the love. It was never a commercial venture. It was creating what you knew was great and what you wanted to create. And as a result, that is how the best art is created. And the fact that it has resonated with so many people, I think, comes from the fact that your heart was always in it.
Yeah, that must be it.
I mean, one of my favorite songs of yours is Awaken, which is just a powerhouse of a track. I mean, you know, it's catchy, it's angry, makes me want to party, punch the air. Like, how do you record or how do you even write a song like that that is so full of energy?
Really putting my hearing at risk. That's how I write a song like that.
I bet.
Yeah, like, I remember that song. So I made the beat for that sitting like cross-legged on my bed, watching my brother play Grand Theft Auto 5. I think that might have had something to do with it.
That'll do it.
That sort of aggression, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh yeah. Like, and the thing is the content of the song is kind of like political and very like angry at the world, or like, I'm awakened to the injustices of what's going on and stuff. But when I was making the beat, it wasn't that at all. Like, it was just me having my my sound stuff open and just finding the right sounds and being like, oh, this sounds like, that sounds like that, and I like that. And then finding the right kicks and snares that sound like this. And when I had my headphones in, I was just, it was it was just something that for me, when I make music, I really follow kind of what's going on, follow my instincts and my heart, right? So when I was finding all these sounds and it was working, I was just rolling with it like, oh yeah, okay, this is sick. And getting like I think the main kind of lead sample on that song is a sort of buzz, like a synth buzz that's just like really, like it's almost like a car revving in your ears. And I think just that really informed kind of the attitude I wanted to take with it. And the lyrical content came with, finishing the beat and then blasting it in my room on my speakers. And just kind of, I was probably running around in circles or something because I get really excited. So that's kind of how something like that happens.
Amazing. And then what was it like when you first played it live? And how much did your uncle kind of coach you in the artistry of taking this incredible kind of creative gene that you have and then putting it onto a stage in front of people?
Yeah, so that was something that I had to learn by being in front of people. I think there are certain things about actually making music that you don't know about until you're performing music. So by the time I'm making Awaken, I think I made that in the summer of 2019. I had done a lot of shows and I had been really active. And I actually, when I was making specifically that song, and I make every song like this, I do think about how it's going to sound in a club or at a certain venue. You know what I mean? Like, I think about, what am I going to say and what sounds am I going to use that I know are going to make an audience like lose their minds? And at the end of that song, I actually add something in that's not in it at all, like until the very end. And it's these sort of like really thunderous drums that are like, dung, 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 like just really wild. And when I did that, I actually put that in the song because I wanted to use it as a physical thing in my shows. So when I get to that part of the song at the end, I start kind of like air drumming and going in these circles and people like, I remember I was like, okay, when I first performed it, I was thinking, I'm going to try this. And I started like air drumming and dancing in a circle or something and being very kind of like, I don't even know what. And I heard like the audience go wild. That really informed me to, going forward to still think about that when making music. And I think being in front of an audience has really impacted how I write and how I produce because of it. So yeah, that's definitely like, all of that comes together when putting a song together and thinking about kind of what's it going to be like in front of people. And I learned all that from my uncle because he knew all the stuff to do whenever we would perform. He knew how to do, when I say wolf, y'all say castle, wolf. You know what I mean? Like he knew how to do call and response and all that stuff. So yeah, I learned that all from him and I'm glad that I'm still using it today.
Amazing. I mean, it's incredible. And of course, I mean, as has been pointed out in many reviews, your music does transcend genres in that you're kind of, you've got this incredible old school hip hop feel and style, but then there is definitely a pop element to it and indeed other genres. Like, who were your musical influences growing up in addition to your uncle?
NSYNC.
Really? That's amazing.
Backstreet Boys.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was a very eclectic sort of inspiration. So I loved NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys and like awesome. Enrique Iglesias.
Amazing. Just all
pop music from the late 90s and early 2000s. Really, like, I love that stuff. Like YTV was like this kids channel here that's still around, and they used to put out compilation CDs called Big Fun Party Mix. And awesome. It was all the pop hits of the day. And I actually have a CD of Big Fun Party Mix 2 sitting on my speakers right now. I'm looking at it. And amazing. It has all these old pop bands on it. So I loved kind of that pop music. And I was really influenced by video game music too. There was this game I loved called Jet Set Radio Future. And it's like these roller skating kind of punk teens spray painting Tokyo in the future. And the soundtrack for that is actually so like amazing because in the game, there's this fake radio station that's always playing music, and just somebody who was involved in the music of that game had to make I don't know, 20 remixes.
Amazing.
And that really influenced me production-wise, kind of like how to chop up samples and use them, right? So it was all of that stuff. And riding around with my uncle, who is my influence, you know, he's not that much older than me. He's 13 years older than I am. So we were pretty close in age, you know, more than you would think an uncle and a nephew would be.
Yeah.
So when I was really young, he was 19, 20 years old, and he had this convertible, this blue convertible, and he used to babysit me and my siblings. And some of my finest memories, certainly they've influenced my love for old school hip hop, you know, like driving through the city and he's like smoking cigars while listening to Jay-Z,
awesome.
Just really loud. Like that was kind of my upbringing. And I actually like, it's so silly. I get nostalgic when I can smell cigars because it makes me think of those days. He was wild, man.
That's nice.
But yeah, so it's old school hip hop. It's pop music from the late 90s and early 2000s. And I just love music so much that I listen to so much all the time, and I'm always challenging myself and trying to like find new things. And I can't say there's one genre of music that I don't like a song from.
Nice. Yeah, and it definitely comes through in your music. You would file it under hip hop in the record store, but there's so many different things going on, and that's definitely what shines through, that you've kind of, you know, exposed yourself to every possible genre. This show is brought to you by Nova Scotia Business Incorporated. NSBI works towards a strong, thriving and globally competitive Nova Scotia through attracting worldwide investment to create new jobs across the province and working with companies in all communities to be more successful exporters. Visit NovaScotiaBusiness.com to learn more about doing business in Nova Scotia. Growing up on a reserve, what are the misconceptions that people have? Because, I mean, your story is so amazing in terms of what you've created, how young you started. But for so many people who don't really understand what life is like there, they wouldn't imagine it to be like this, this kind of extremely kind of artistic, creative, embracing of all creative outlets. How do you describe it to people, and what are people's misconceptions?
Yeah, the misconceptions obviously come from people not spending time there. And you know what?
Right.
There, unfortunately, there's been a lot of generational trauma too, right, with the Indigenous community. So it's, you know, it's people that have been oppressed for generations and generations. And even that, like, if you grow up in that and you don't have the right kind of influences and people around, you could end up somewhere else completely.
Right.
But I think that's, you know, that's the same sort of story for anyone that kind of grows up or is part of a minority group or in some sort of impoverished, you know, town or who knows what, right? Like, I find like with anything, if people are ignorant to something or have misconceptions, they always come from a lack of communication with that thing that you are ignorant about, right? Because it was very strange to grow up kind of in two different worlds is how I see it. Because on top of sort of the misconceptions and the you know, the definite oppression and sort of problems that you have to face, there's that other layer of Indigenous culture and different ways of thinking and approaching things. You know what I mean? That causes a very strange culture clash when somebody from the reserve goes into the outside world, as, you know, it would be easy for me to refer it as. I think for me, I was very fortunate in a sense that I actually was able to grow up in both places, because like Pabino First Nation, where I'm from, is so small. It's just residential. Like, there's a gas station and there's a restaurant now, but when I was a kid, it was very much not like that. So, you know, it's so small that like a lot of reserves around New Brunswick in Canada at large, you know, they have, I don't know, a couple thousand people, and they'll have their own schools and their own stores and kind of their own infrastructure. So really, if you're from there, you don't have much of a reason to leave.
Right.
So there is a culture that exists within that. And so for me, that wasn't around. So I had to go to school in Bathurst. I had to do groceries in Bathurst. I have friends from Bathurst. So I think I learned the Western North American way and the First Nations way. And
amazing.
I had to switch I had to switch between the two depending on where I was. And I, because I spent so much time in Bathurst going to school and doing everything every day, you know, I kind of grew up really, you know, in that, with the weird kind of thing attached to me, and weird at the time for me, the indigenous culture identity thing, because there were pieces of my culture, like songs and practices and traditional stories and dances and stuff like that, that I grew up around and knew about. But for me, that wasn't different or weird. So I didn't really see it as completely separate from kind of quote unquote Western world stuff. The only time it would become apparent would be when I'm in school and my grandfather comes in to give a presentation on sort of, you know, I'm Ilnu, which is just the name of kind of my people, and we speak Mi'kmaq, but a lot of people will refer to us as Mi'kmaq, and that's fine. Right. So that's just kind of how we're, I guess, colloquially known. But my grandfather was a storyteller, and he's still, you know, he's an educator, so he would come in and talk about the culture and how he grew up, because he was born here and he grew up very traditional, kind of, you know, born and raised, you know, on the reserve and you know, living off the land and stuff. And it would only become apparent that I was different when something like that would happen, and I would hear the ignorant comments from my classmates making fun of, I don't know, you know, traditional words and teachings and pretending that it was kind of silly and ridiculous. And that would really sting. Because, yeah, you know, when you're an awkward teenager, especially for me, like, you just want to fit in, right? Like, you don't want to be separated from the crowd. So for me, I spent a lot of my time until I was around 20 years old kind of rejecting my traditional roots, even though I lived on the reserve. I was very involved in the culture and my community. I just rejected it, and I wanted to be, I didn't want to be a part of it. Like, even to the point where I identified myself as like this suburban middle-class white kid, even though that's not true, like, right, which is very strange. Like, especially for me to come to terms with once I leave the reserve and I tell stories about, you know, kind of the scary stuff that would happen that would be normalized to me, and have people I'd met in university being like, what are you talking about? That is insane. Right. So that was like a culture shock for me, you know, because I was very protected too from my family really protected me from kind of the negative stuff that goes on in these communities, you know? And for me, I did have frustration feeling like I was kind of stuck in a bubble almost, but then I understood how hard they had worked, you know, to keep these kind of negative influences out. And I understood that sacrifice was to make me, you know, grow up feeling pretty normal and stable. And it, you know, thinking about it now, it's kind of a shame that even had to happen. But right, me identifying myself, as a suburban middle-class white kid, even though, you know, I was very much not that, was a survival technique that, it was like a judo move that my mom pulled.
Right. Well, it's one of those things, as you say, it was to protect you, but it is a tricky thing when you're bridging, you know, essentially two identities. And also, I mean, for you being in school, it must have been that's a real moment of trauma when classmates who previously, to say, hearing your grandfather speak, you just thought of them as just friends, and then suddenly you see this kind of awful, bigoted, evil side to them. That's got to really, really hurt. I mean, for anyone, but especially as a teenager who has these different identities, both of which are as important to you as the other.
Yeah, it was really bad, you know, and it really hurt. And I think what hurt me the most was I knew that they didn't realize how bad it was. Like, I remember in middle school, there were these friends of mine I had, and they used to make fun of me for being Native, like, literally every day. Mm. And it made me feel so small and so awful. But after they would do that, they would just say, you know, we're just kidding, right? Like, but it didn't it didn't make it hurt any less, you know what I mean?
Of course, yeah. And as you say, it's lack of education, and that's one of the things that's been missing for so long, is people don't realize they don't realize the historical awfulness of what they're doing and what they're perpetuating. But yeah, I think that's the thing. It's that ignorance that makes it all the more depressing. That's what makes bigotry so depressing, is that it comes from stupidity.
Right. Yeah, it does. And you know, it's like, and you know, I would talk about this and I had, you know, parents and aunts and uncles and my siblings, we all grew up and we all went to the same schools and everything, and they had that experience as well. So I was fortunate enough to have intelligent, you know, smart family members who had faced this already and could tell me, you know, like, it hurts and it sucks, but it is because they're ignorant and they might not really understand what they're doing, and it still doesn't excuse it. But, you know, it's that. So as a kid, I realized that it was coming from a place of ignorance. And I think luckily I interpreted it in a way that, oh, they're ignorant and it sucks, but I'm not going to, you know, hold any hatred or resentment for it. I'm just going to try and rise above that and show them that, you know, it, you know, like, whatever. I'm going to show them that I can do what I'm going to do, and I'm going to be really successful at it. And it's not out of spite. It's just to be like, look, you were wrong about this, and you probably heard this ignorant stuff from your parents. And what we're going to do now is we're going to move forward as a culture, and, you know, we're going to get smarter.
And the amazing thing that you've done with your songs is, of course, that you can, you know, like your grandfather, you are a storyteller. The videos and the songs tell a story. Do you feel a responsibility to now educate your audience and your fan base about things about, you know, the Indigenous community that they may not have known before?
Yeah, I do feel that responsibility because I just know that there are a lot of reasons why I am the way I am and I'm in the position that I'm in. Mm-hmm. And some of them were not in my control, just happened to be born into a family that was very supportive and very artistic. You know, I just happened to, for some reason, the cards fell a specific way, and now I'm the way I am, and here I am sitting here talking. So I feel that responsibility to educate and approach it in a way that is not going to make people roll their eyes and just shut off, because like sometimes it can be like that too. Like, so for me, I do feel that responsibility, but I tell myself, I'm going to just be myself and speak my truth the best that I can, and take those opportunities to talk about where I come from, because even though my story is very different in a certain way, it is very similar to a lot of other Indigenous youth specifically, and people that are, you know, everywhere who grew up in who knows what kind of situation. So I really look up to a lot of artists and musicians and people, and they help me as well get through things and think about things, you know, like specific artists, like, I don't know, Mac Miller was really influential to me because he was, you know, 4 years older than I am and had no label and was independent and was putting music out. And I really looked up to that. And I actually really love Conan O'Brien, the talk show host, because he's just such a good interviewer. And he, you know, will take moments to just be funny and talk about stuff, but he'll also be real. And I love listening to podcasts and people talk about their lives. And it, I find like just having really deep conversations with people, or even listening to them, will inform myself, because I just reflect on what I hear and, you know, put that into my life's context and try and figure out where to go next. So I do feel that responsibility to educate and be a storyteller, but that's kind of the way that I'm going to do it, is through music, through entertainment, because I just think that's the best way that I specifically can do it.
Beautiful. And it's working. And I love that you love Conan. And it's funny, because one of my favorite quotes is actually above my desk here, and it's a Conan quote. Oh. And it's the line, and it's this line he said about 10 years ago. He said, I hate cynicism. It's my least favorite quality, and it doesn't lead anywhere. Nobody in life gets exactly what they thought they were going to get. But if you work really hard and you're kind, amazing things will happen. And I think you are the living embodiment of that quote.
Oh man, I've heard that quote before. I really have. I forget what the context was, but yeah. See, you know, if I probably heard that and applied that to my life, right? So that's all part of it.
That's it. It's definitely something which, of course, I mean, it is the case everywhere, but it feels like in a place like New Brunswick that isn't necessarily used to having, artists, whether they be, painters, writers, musicians, comedians, whatever they are, it isn't used to it. So it feels like it's quite a unique place to be doing what we do, because there isn't a well-worn path. We literally have to find our own. And really, you just have to love what you're doing. And I love that feeling of watching you perform and listen to you. It sounds like you are having fun, which is what it's all about.
Yeah, exactly. And I often wonder, what the heck is going on? Like, there's so many people that get into this, not even get into it. Like, there were so many people in, now or when I was coming up that were in bands or, were trying to be actors or making music and stuff. And, I wonder why they're not sticking with it, right? But I think that a really important thing is the love for it. I think if you get into the entertainment industry with the wrong intentions, that you're just going to suffer a lot more and you're not going to last, because it is really hard to try and be something, in music and arts. If you want to be I don't even know how to be a painter. Like, what do you even, I don't know. What do you do? I have no idea. But, you have to be so brave to do that. And I think part of it is you have to literally live and breathe it to the point where you can't quit, because you're just not going to. Because, like, the way I look at it is, and I always tell myself this kind of to take the pressure off of being, quote unquote, a successful artist, is would I be making music anyway if I was making literally 1 cent or not? Yeah. And the answer is yes, I would be making music. If I, if nobody heard one note from me, I would still be making music. So I know that it's something that my heart is truly in,
I think you're right. And I think that's totally what I love so much about East Coast music, and indeed the East Coast art scene, is that no one's in it for the victory or the glory or the wealth, because we're probably not going to have that. It's not going to happen. Like, we're not going to be millionaires from this. We're in it for the love. Whereas, if you do what we do in England or LA or indeed or New York, you are surrounded with people who are literally in it for the riches. And we know there ain't no riches for us. We are literally surrounded with people who are passionate about what we do. And that's one of the things that I love about finding myself in a dressing room on any show, back when we're allowed to do live shows and live events again, is that, if I'm in a room full of, storytellers, poets, musicians, the one thing that we're all going to have in common is that we are all doing this for the love and not for any other reason. And I think that's what makes this place quite unique, how do you describe New Brunswick to people when you're on the road and they haven't been? Like, how do you explain it to people?
It's funny. I'm from New Brunswick, and sometimes depending on how far west you are, they go, "What?
What's that? What's that? What is that?" They don't know that there are things east of Quebec. They're like, "Doesn't Canada end at Quebec?"
Oh man, or if if I'm in America, and I'm like, "I'm from New Brunswick," they're like, "Oh, New Jersey? Because there's a New Brunswick, New Jersey." Like, I was in New York one time, just on a trip, and I told someone I was just random that I was from New Brunswick, and they thought I was like across the pond or like in Newark, New Jersey or something, because there is a New Brunswick there. But no, I would say New Brunswick has a weird rep in Canada. I think people think that it's a drive-through province and something that just sucks, but like... It's not like it's super cool. Like if you, and it's hard. It is hard as a resident of New Brunswick and as like an edgy teen that hates everything to like sit there and actually, look at New Brunswick for what it is, because I also would like, be part of the NB hate, as a young person, because I want to live in a big city, blah, blah, blah. But once I got older, you know, you take a look around and it's a beautiful province. There's so much, like, it's so scenic and there's so many nice people and just a lot of history and a lot of, I don't know, it just feels very welcoming and open. And it feels just, I don't know, it's, and maybe it's because I'm from here and I've learned that I actually do love it. But I love traveling through this province and seeing kind of what it has to offer. And I think it's one of the most beautiful places on earth. I mean, think about it. You know, there's no tornadoes. There's no earthquakes. We're not getting a tsunami next week. You know what I mean? Like, it's got to be one of the most calmest places, you know?
It's true. Even COVID couldn't hit us.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it sucks, but like we've got it. My sister lives in Charleston, South Carolina, the United States. Wow. If she came up here, I think she would just, you know, it's a breeze. Like she's in the heat of America right now, like in their COVID thing. It sucks.
Totally. Oh, totally. I mean, I speak to friends in England and they're like, oh, James, things are going really great here. We're down to 10,000 deaths a day on my street. And I'm like, oh, we got 30 cases in the whole province.
Yeah.
But it's crazy times. But I mean, this is the thing that's, I think, so wonderful, is that you've built up this career, you've built up this following, and you know and you've used this time in lockdown to create. And then in 6 months or even less, when we're able to go on the road again, your audience is waiting for you. I mean, what are you looking forward to most about performing live again?
I'm looking forward to, I miss one of my old tricks I had up my sleeve for shows. Was jumping into the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, when we start doing shows again, I don't know if I could do that, but...
With a mask on, it's fine.
Yeah. I'll put a mask on. I'll wear a hazmat suit. That's what I'll do. Yes. That's just going to be like the next phase of Wolf Castle. I'll just have a hazmat like theme going on so it makes sense.
Yeah, but, it's your Daft Punk thing, right?
Yeah, it's my Daft Punk phase. Like, I don't want people to see my face. Like, if I get old, I'll start wearing a mask just so people don't see my wrinkles and stuff. I miss, what I'm looking forward to the most is being able to, scream out loud and, you know, be in a sweaty bar. I never thought I would say that, but a sweaty, weird little bar or something, and you're putting your tunes on and I'm just going for it and hearing people scream the chorus back at me and you know, making that connection, being like, hey, like we're all here right now. We're in this moment. And that is something that I miss so much, is being able to look an audience member in the eyes and, like, you know, do a little wave or something, and then, you know, you're vibing together, like, and making that connection. So I really miss that physical aspect of it. And you know, when you are playing music live, you feel the music because it's so loud, like the bass in my songs, I can feel them in my legs. And that helps the performance a lot. Like, it's really hard actually to write songs that aren't really writing songs that aren't cerebral and like philosophical and stuff. Like, I can't, how come I gonna write a party track when I don't know when I'm gonna be at the party next, you know? So
it's true.
So I miss that.
Well, it won't be long, and I can't thank you enough for your time here today, Tristan. As I say, I'm a huge fan. It's a real honor to get to know you, and I wish you the best of luck at the ECMAs next month, mate.
Yeah, thanks so much for chatting with me. Like, you've been a great guy to talk to. I'm telling you. Like, I mean, I'm in lockdown. There's not a lot of people I'm talking to right now, so it feels nice. Good to have a conversation, especially with another artist too. Like, it feels good. Oh,
thanks, man. The feeling's mutual. I can't wait for us to see each other on the road. But most importantly, I can't wait to be standing in an audience as you play Awaken, and then you jump into the crowd and we get to high five. I mean, in a sweaty bar. This is that day will come, and I can't wait for it, brother.
Yes, and you're getting the VIP ticket. You're coming in. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. We will see you on the road, and thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much. I'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now.
The show is brought to you by Nova Scotia Business Incorporated. NSBI works towards a strong, thriving and globally competitive Nova Scotia through attracting worldwide investment to create new jobs across the province and working with companies in all communities to be more successful exporters. Visit NovaScotiaBusiness.com to learn more about doing business in Nova Scotia. Wolfcastle was announced as part of the 2021 ECMA Festival and Conference this May 5th to 9th in Sydney, Nova Scotia. Socially distanced arena seating is on sale now for the 2021 East Coast Music Awards show via Ticketmaster. All ECMA in-person events will comply with public health measures. For more information on the 2021 East Coast Music Awards, please visit ecma.com. Be sure to follow Wolfcastle on Facebook, search for Wolfcastle, and on Instagram and Twitter, at Real Wolfcastle, and purchase his music now from Apple Music. Further details can be found on the Edit website, maritimeedit.com, and I will see you next time.
Podstarter.